Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Real spoilers powered by ReviewSTL.com.
Warning, the following film discussion will ruin the ending of any movie you haven't seen. Example, Bruce Willis is dead at the end of The Sixth Sense. See how I ruined it for you? Just like that. Here are a few more.
Silent breed is people!
I am the father.
Get it?
Real spoilers. You've been warned.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 592, The Dirty Dozen, Next Mission.
Oh, just Next Mission. They couldn't even afford the?
Right. Yes. No the, just Next Mission. I made a point to say that properly.
This is for TV. It's like a newspaper words, right? Like character counts?
You know, it might have been. You know, it might have been like because the TV guide, yeah. They'd publish that. You know, you have limited space. That could have factored into their thought process. So before we dig in, let's go around the virtual table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Paul.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Yeah, Paul is back because it's like if you're going to get to watch the good one, you got to sit through the lousy one, too.
Those we should have just had him on for The Dirty Dozen, The Next Mission.
Right. That's how you know when we really don't like you. If we just invite you on for just the made-for-TV sequel, that's our little passive-aggressive dick.
I'm out.
Yeah.
We would never do that to Paul, though.
So quick shameless plugs. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Check us out on Facebook, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. And, of course, our Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month, you get all sorts of bonus content, and you help out, and we appreciate it. So, there we go. So, Dirty Dozen, The Next Mission, war is hell, and you can really tell by just how much they've aged in what has to be 3 weeks.
No kidding.
Like, this, the first movie took place, like, you know, within 3 weeks of the end of World War II. Like, it's right before D-Day, and now we get a sequel, and we'll get two more sequels. And I'm just like, how many missions are you cramming in there in those final weeks?
Well, so Lee Marvin was like, 43 in the first movie. And I mentioned on the last episode, like, he looks like an old 43. I mean, I'm not trying to be catty or anything, but it's just like, it looks like he's seen some stuff. That is a 43-year-old today. Like, I mean, that, I don't know. Anyway. It's a rough 43. And this movie took place in what? Was it like 15 years later or
18.
Something?
It's 18 years. So the first one came out in 67. This was on, this premiered, I think, February 4th, 1985, which also the February timestamp means this was a big deal. Like February is rating sweeps, you know?
Sweeps, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like you pull out, you know, pun intended, your big guns for February, and they, you know, and honestly, I mean, The Dirty Dozen is a big movie for them to, you know, make an official sequel to that. I mean, to get Lee Marvin, to get Ernest Borgnine. Well, getting Ernest Borgnine wasn't quite so difficult. Getting Richard Jackal. I'm not sure how you say it.
Jackal.
Okay. Getting, you know, them back probably wasn't as difficult, but to get Lee Marvin, the you know, basically the face of that movie, was that's a big deal for a TV.
You think that's a big deal? They got Larry Wilcox for this.
Larry Wilcox of Chips fame.
Yes.
So he's the Kevin, you mentioned how none of them are recognizable. None of them are recognizable to your generation. Most of them aren't, but Larry Wilcox would have definitely been recognizable because he was on Chips with Eric Estrada, which was a hugely successful show. I mean, it was one of the few TV shows that actually had their own action figure. That's not a common occurrence back then. So
sure. I just, you know, at least I could recognize the first, you know, in the first one, at least I could follow along with Donald Sutherland, Charles Bronson, John Cassavetes. Like, these are people that I absolutely know.
Totally. Yeah.
And I'm sure at the time, of course, people were actors of the day, so you'd recognize them easier. But to me, at least, you know, in retrospect, like looking at them now, I could not follow who.
I think the only actor that would have any degree of name recognition would be Larry Wilcox. Would you agree, Paul?
Yeah. Yeah. Ken Wall is the other one who was famous in the 80s, but he wouldn't become famous until a few years later for that. It wasn't called Firefly. What was the series he was on, Tom?
I don't remember. What?
Which one is this?
It was the Ken Wall. Oh, Wise Guy.
Wise Guy. Oh, he's on Wise Guy. Okay.
So that wasn't until 2 years later.
Yeah, and I will say the guy who plays the Native American member of the Dirty Dozen, Sam Sixkiller, you might recognize as Billy Bear from 48 Hours. He's the Indian that they're looking for throughout 48 Hours.
Oh, yeah.
I want to say that he was typecast, but in every movie he was in, he played the Indian.
Right.
Because he was in Predator. That's one for Joe.
Oh, that's right. He was in Predator.
You would recognize that, certainly.
So, But yeah, like, I find it fascinating that, like they're trying to squeeze more stories out of this, and it's like the war is, for all practical intents and purposes, over, you know?
I found a lot of things interesting about this movie, but this movie, I noticed, starts off and has almost the same script as the first one.
Oh my God, there are multiple lines of dialogue that are lifted completely from the original. I mean, and it happens, I mean, 7 or 8 times throughout the film.
And I could not believe Ernest Borgnine and Lee Marvin talking, like, together. I mean, I could not believe how they were repeating the same lines of dialogues and even like the same jokes.
Right.
Like it blew my mind that they basically just took the script. So to me, I was thinking like, this is less of a sequel. It is technically a sequel, but it's more of like a made for TV adaptation, similar to like what they did with, what was the one, not Butch and Sundance, but what was the other one we did, where they just flipped the names, like it was...
The Sting 2.
The Sting 2.
Yeah.
The Sting 2 is the same plot, but they just twist it around a little bit, and then they even give them different names. They're like
slightly
same
different
names,
yeah.
But they're slightly different. So with this movie, this is basically like, let's make the Dirty Dozen, but let's make it for TV, and it will be a sequel.
Which could work, except they subtitled it Next Mission.
Right. But yeah, when you use the same plot and you have some of the same characters, it plays really strange. So anyway, I thought that was really strange. And
I have,
threw me
just
off.
Real quick on that, I have in my notes, the world's most dangerous drinking game. Take a shot every time they repeat a line or scene from the original film.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I can see this being one of those movies where it's done by committee. So, you know, somebody in Hollywood says, I got a great idea. We do a sequel to The Dirty Dozen. Oh, that'd be great, because all the people who saw the original, they loved that movie. It made a ton of money.
Right.
And we can definitely bring them to TV. And then somebody else says, well, what about the people who haven't seen the movie, which was 18 years ago? Well, then they won't know that we're using the exact same script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The script reads like, if someone had seen the movie once 20 years ago, and then they said, now write the script for that movie, like from memory.
It is. And so I found it really lazy how blatant it was that they ripped the same lines of dialogue, because if you're remaking a movie or if you're adapting a movie for TV, fine, use the same dialogue. But this is a straight sequel. So how do you take the same exact dialogue and say the same things if it's supposed to be a sequel. So it was really muddy the way they did that. And then the plot is what got me, like, I had to have Tom kind of explain this to me because I started watching the movie. And so getting right into it, Ernest Borgnine is playing golf and is he with Scottish or someone from the UK?
He's like with like a British guy and a French guy.
Yeah, another forces. They're playing golf.
And a French guy.
You can tell you can tell he's French because he keeps going, hum, hum, hum.
Yes.
And he has a beret on, yeah. And he's golfing with a baguette, which was a really odd choice.
Yeah, he's literally holding a baguette, yeah.
So anyway, the British officer is talking to Ernest Borgnine while they're playing golf. He ends up telling him that there's another Nazi officer that's going to kill Hitler. And he's like, whoa, we can't have someone kill Hitler. And like, I took it, and I was wrong, but I took it as like they're saying like they don't want Hitler to die because they have to kill Hitler. And so I didn't understand, and I asked Tom, I'm like, why is the plot of this movie that they have to kill someone before they kill Hitler? That seems awful. And Tom had explained it that this is very toward the end of Hitler's power and that he was doing a terrible job, and so that if someone younger and more motivated came in and replaced him, the war would drag out. Did I get that correct?
Yeah, that's my take on it.
It's so ridiculous on paper, and I get where they're coming from now that it's been explained, but when you told me that the Dirty Dozen has to go kill the guy trying to kill Hitler, I thought, what a ridiculous, as if the first one wasn't ridiculous enough. That just sounds ludicrous to me.
I kind of like the idea. Like, it's ludicrous, but I mean, let's be honest, the first movie's premise is kind of ridiculous, right? So like that they would use all these death row people, like that that's your best option, like that, no it's not, but so it's like I'm kind of okay with a ridiculous thing, but using their own world that they've created, right? In the original Dirty Dozen, the premise was they were going to kill all these people at the chateau in France, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because it's this big giant Nazi party, it's a Nazi party for the Nazi party, and that there'd be all these leaders there, and it would cause, basically, it would kind of damage their talent pool and disrupt, you know, the talent pool and put lesser qualified people in charge to make decisions in conjunction with D-Day, right?
Right.
So if your whole thing was let's disrupt a chain of command last time, well, if you assassinate Hitler, you should have theoretically created a power vacuum beneath him 2 weeks ago, right?
Excuse me. Are we talking about a TV movie that you're trying to apply logic to?
That's all we've got.
Good call on that. So we get into it, and it is it's the same movie essentially. So
their goal is
a little bit different, but it still has to do with killing Nazis. And he's just going around, meaning Reisman, played by Lee Marvin, going around. Ernest Borgnine even says, he basically, in not so many words, says, yeah, you've done this before, go ahead and do it again.
Well, and I guess one of the little changes they make this time, which is, I guess, Lee Marvin was caught stealing liquor or something.
He's stealing whiskey, they said.
And steaks.
Yeah, whiskey and steaks meant for like superior officers.
Right.
He ended up stealing them and giving them to his men. So you're right, Reisman is actually going to do jail time, like 3 years hard labor or something.
Yeah, so like that's how they kind of coerce him into doing it instead, which is like, you don't even need to do it. You can just order them to do it. It's the military.
Right.
That's kind of their jam.
Not only that, if you're Reisman and you're in that situation and they caught you with that stuff and, ooh, the generals didn't get to have their filet mignon,
yeah,
wouldn't you go to them, excuse me, did you hear about the chalet that I just hit?
Right.
Yeah.
I took out like 300 German officers and we used gasoline. Did I mention any of that?
Yeah.
And really, you're gonna send me to jail for 3 years for taking some steaks?
Dude, yeah. It should be called Reisman's Omaha Steak Company. He should get whatever he wants at this point.
It's funny, he's gonna go to jail for stealing whiskey, not for turning a machine gun on a superior officer.
Yes, that's exactly. Thank you. Go listen to the last episode if you haven't. I'm sure you have. But so it's ridiculous all around. But Ernest Borgnine says, like, I know the man for the job. And so they end up getting Reisman to do it because he's wanted for stake theft and whatever. So he assembles a team of not everybody you saw in the last movie. They just try to assemble the exact same archetypes, yeah, basically. Some of them are hybrids, but it's for all intents and purposes.
You get your crazy guy. Yeah. You get your token black guy.
It's the same team.
Yeah.
But I will say, what was really funny is I made this joke way before we watched the movie, but 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm like, they really missed an opportunity by not calling this the Dirty Baker's Dozen. And then in this movie, they enlist 13 people, and Reisman's like, not a dozen, a baker's dozen. I just thought, I'm like, oh, okay.
Man, how bored does Lee Marvin look in this movie? There are times when, like, I really feel like they had to do multiple takes to like edit around his eye rolling. Like,
you know, he was thinking, look, I was drunk through the first movie. Now I'm sober. And I thought, I'm seeing the same movie in my head over and over again. Yeah. Get me out of here.
There's a scene where he's given the Dirty Dozen the speech about how, like, if you screw up just one time. And, I mean, and it's verbatim from the original. And, right, like, and he's just so monotone. And, like, you could just, he's practically shaking his head while he says the lines. This is so clearly something he did for the money. Like, a little backstory, and I think this is what this is the sole reason this movie exists, but Lee Marvin was involved in a very, very, very famous and extremely well publicized not divorce, because he wasn't married to her. But he was with this lady for quite a period of time, and it's actually the case where they coined the phrase palimony, which is alimony for someone you're not married to. And
I had never heard that word before.
Yeah, and he had to cut her a very significant check, and it went back and forth in court for, I think, 4 or 5 years. I mean, it went on for a long time, and I mean, it was like a running gag on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And I mean, it was a big, big story, and it cost him a lot of money. And I think the only reason, cause he didn't like the first movie. He thought it was a bad movie. He didn't care for it. And so,
well, I was reading that he said that it was a stupid movie while he was making it, but didn't he turn around and admit that it was a good movie? Like, once it was done, I read that he was like,
yeah,
okay, it's good.
But I mean, he wasn't, it's not, you know, and but he immediately used the cachet that he got from The Dirty Dozen to turn around and make Point Blank, which is really a really good movie, but very different. Like, he did not want to make these kind of movies.
Yes, I could see an actor thinking that the material is beneath them and doing it for a paycheck. This going and doing a TV movie of The Dirty Dozen kind of makes me think of like Wesley Snipes or Nicolas Cage or John Travolta,
right,
doing these just straight to DVD terrible movies because they need to pay their taxes or need to pay for whatever it is.
Right.
Like, it has to be, because also, I don't know if anyone knows the story. I don't, but like 18 years later, what took so long to make a sequel, and why did they decide to do this? Does anyone know the reason?
I would like to think that the Hollywood executives that the idea was brought to said, no, we're not doing that. Get out.
Oh, so they sold it to TV.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is twofold. Is one, Hollywood wasn't as sequel driven back then. Like, I mean, I'm not saying it never happened, but now that's the first thing they, you know, I promise you, like, in some Hollywood office somewhere, some executive has said, could we get a Schindler's List too? Let's ask ourselves that question. Like, somebody has had the balls to say that, right? Like, but back then they weren't as motivated by that. It was more about stars, right? So it's like, if it's like, well, let's make the next Humphrey Bogart movie, let's make the next John Wayne movie.
Well, tell me about it. We just did one. How about the sequel to the Maltese Falcon called The Black Bird?
Yeah.
And the title, but above the tiny little The Blackbird title, nowhere does it say Maltese Falcon,
right,
but it says you'll love George Siegel's bird or whatever.
Yeah,
on it. Like, it's all about the people. Like, you'd write the movie posters were all Humphrey Bogart and
one, it wasn't the mindset, but two,
sure,
I think they also thought, well, I mean, they killed off almost everybody. So it's like, you know, like, do people want to see Dirty Dozen without Charles Bronson, without John Cassavetes, without, you know what I mean? Like, all you had left were, you still had Charles Bronson. His character lived, but for the most part, all the main people died. So you had Lee Marvin and Charles Bronson.
That's a missed opportunity that only three survived of the actual fighters, you know?
Yeah. And like in today's world, they wouldn't let that happen. They would leave a lot more of the Dirty Dozen alive. Yeah.
You'd have to have a half to mix back in.
Yeah, for that very reason. And I will say to this movie's credit, what little credit I'll give it, I mean, they get back, three of the five biggest names of characters who are still left alive. Like, right, like you get Bowron and you get Ernest Borgnine's character, Warden, right? And then you get Lee Marvin. And so the only big names I can think of who were left alive would be George Kennedy and Charles Bronson. And
yeah.
Charles Bronson still had he was about a decade away from entering the TV movie phase of his career. So
yeah, I was going to say, I think that's the missed opportunity of this, is not having anyone in the Dirty Dozen be connective tissue, right? So
yeah,
if you would have had Charles Bronson leading the group or kind of showing like, I've been here, I've been, you know, referencing some stuff they've done in the past, some callbacks, I think that you would have had a better movie. But because the rest of the cast is so forgettable and you don't have the connective tissue other than Lee Marvin, but he's doing the exact same thing with a lot of the same lines.
Yeah.
It really falls apart there.
But here's the problem. Charles Bronson would have looked 18 years older.
Yeah.
Lee Marvin and Ernest Borgnine, even though it was 18 years later, they looked essentially the same.
Lee Marvin looks 90 in this movie. I hate to tell you, but
he
looks
looked old in the first one.
I know he did.
You know what I mean? I think considering it's 20 years later, Lee Marvin looks pretty good. Like, Ernest Borgnine obviously looks older. Like, his hair is thinner and it's not as dark, but like, I still believe him as a general, and he's, you know, he clearly shot all of his scenes in 2 days. But you're also
applying logic to this movie that we've already said is out the window. So if you can get Charles Bronson, I think you get Charles Bronson, and I think if you could get
Charles Bronson, you would have made a theatrical film.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Because he was still a box office draw. Like, they were still, I mean, for Canon films, but they were still making money. Like, you know, like,
that
honestly
may have been the difference, though.
That's what they should have done. Like, they should have been a Canon film and just gotten really weird with it.
And gotten crazy. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's the same exact story. They're trying to take out this General Dietrich, who is like Hitler's right-hand man, because he's trying to take out Hitler and overtake him and run the Nazi party. So they get together the Dirty Dozen, which ends up being 13 of them at first. But as soon as the guy mouths off, which I think is an homage to Franco, during the lineup this time, the 13 of them, he mouths off, and immediately Lee Marvin makes an example of him. He says, take him back to prison. And, you know, I don't know if this guy was one sentenced to death or hard labor, but whatever it is, he's going back. And he never flinched. Lee Marvin never was like, okay, see, that's what's going to happen to you. Like, no, they take the dude away.
Yeah.
And they're back down to the Dirty Dozen pretty quickly. But I will say, we didn't mention on the last episode, but I do in my research, the Dirty Dozen is actually based on a real group of people. So it was actually, was it the Filthy 13 or something like that?
Yeah, there's supposedly something called the Filthy 13.
And I'm sure that a lot of it is like, you know, stories that were passed down and whatever. But
yeah.
But apparently there is some truth rooted in this Filthy 13. And so I think maybe that was, maybe I'm giving him too much credit, but maybe doing the Filthy 13 in this movie was like an homage to the real people who the story was based on. But anyway, they get back down to the Dirty Dozen, which, you know, it's called the Dirty Dozen. They can't have 13 of them. So they could have with my idea, but they're back down to that. And they say, hey, we've got to go on this suicide mission, and none of the guys trust him. And just like in the first one, they're like, you're not a general or corporal or whatever, like captain, you can't commute my sentence. And Lee Marvin's just like, yeah, well, I can, so believe me. And they like, okay, so they all end up okay. They reluctantly go with him. And this one, I think it's even worse than Franco, though, because like, Franco was insubordinate and always was like, I'm going to escape and all this. But in this movie, the Franco character is like, yeah, the second he turns around, I'm going to put a bullet in his back.
I'm going to kill him, yeah.
Like, I mean, this guy, like, they are really much more reluctant to help him. Like, these guys are all pretty much like, yeah, we'll go with you, but we're going to escape, basically.
Yeah.
So...
But they were introducing the characters real quick, I thought it was, like, weird. Like, they're introducing all these, like, murderers and rapists, and then they get to a guy, his name's Conrad, and his crime was he was caught stealing from the bodies of dead soldiers.
Oh, looting, right. And then Lee Marvin says, yeah, I used to do that, too.
No, Lee Marvin, he's like, that's the one where he's like a... no, I think it's the guy who's taking German souvenirs that he was talking about.
Yeah. Oh, I thought that's who you were talking. Okay,
no, there's
sorry.
A guy that was stealing from the bodies of American soldiers.
Okay,
like and Lee Marvin doesn't even go in his cell. He's like, "Let me in there, and I'll kill him myself."
But
and
that's
like,
what I didn't understand. I
was like,
he...
"But there was rapists and killers."
I know, but I got it confused. I thought they were the same person, but I didn't realize I must have looked away that they had cut to it because they literally are the same back and forth. If it's
they
not the
are.
Same person.
I, like, honestly, I kept getting distracted. I backed it up and watched it a couple times to make sure.
So they
sure
just
I...
cut to the next one after that.
They
then.
Did.
Because I heard him go, let me in there and I'll kill him myself, just like you after the rapist and everything. And then he's like, you got caught stealing stuff off of German soldiers.
Yeah.
And Lee Marvin's like, yeah, I've been known to do that too, but it's called looting. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
Like, what? It's so weird. Okay. Well, thank you for clarifying. They're two different people. That was a very odd choice to have those back to back, but
it
anyway.
Was, and the actors even looked similar. It was,
it's very confusing. So he gets them all together and he enlists them, and their mission is to go to an airfield, I believe, their first assignment that they think they're going to get this guy. They're going to intercept the plane of this lieutenant of Hitler's where he's going to come in. Or is it a train or a plane?
It's a train. Kind of they're going to
train. Okay.
Train. Yeah.
So the train is going to come in, and so they're going to end up killing him. Well, it ends up that when they land at the airport, the Nazi soldiers identify the black guy. Like, they're dressed up again as Nazis, but they wouldn't have
right? Like, how did you not predict? Yeah. I mean, honestly, when I watched The Dirty Dozen the first time, that was my first thought. I'm like, you're dropping a black guy behind enemy lines in Germany? Like,
it doesn't... It's such a... Because they use the same thing twice in this movie to get them caught.
But in the first movie, Jim Brown doesn't pretend to be a German.
Right.
In this one, they're having the guy... whatever his name was, the black guy, he has to dress up like the rest of them in Nazi uniforms.
It makes no sense.
Right.
Because
it's that sort of thing where at the prison where Lee Marvin was interviewing the guys, hey, buddy, I'd love to bring you along, but our plan is to put everybody in Nazi uniforms and pretend to be German. They're going to see right through that.
Right.
Why did they not have him on the outskirts like they do at the end of the movie? Have him be a sniper where he's not in uniform. Like, don't have him go into, I don't know. They could have done it smarter.
There's a lot of things they could have done smarter.
So
let's wrap him up in gauze.
Their genius plan is to wrap his head up in bandages so that he will not be identified as being black. But then the guy ends up spotting his hands are black. Like, he couldn't have worn gloves? Did gloves not exist? Were they not in the budget?
Well, they didn't think about it till they were on the plane. Like, right?
Okay.
So, now, I don't even know why they had gauze on the plane.
So wrap his hands up in gauze.
Yeah.
I mean, it's stupid. So they identify him, and then so they end up having to steal a bus that's on the airfield, and this is where you get the first, like, big action scene of the movie. There's a bunch of Nazis on motorcycles chasing them down, and they're shooting out the back of the bus, and big
They spent some money on this thing.
Yeah, no, it's a big action set piece. I mean,
especially
for
a made-for-TV movie.
This is some of the worst stunt
but
work
for
I've
for
seen.
A TV movie.
For a made-for-TV movie, circa 1985, I think this is about as good as it gets.
That's what I'm saying. For what it is, I agree. It's not the greatest thing that we've seen, but for what it is, it's like, okay, they actually...
But yes, this is like Six Flags stunt show level work. I will not deny that, but I will also
like,
say...
What is this going to cost us to make this look good? About $100,000. How much is our budget? $45.
Yeah. But it's like I said, for made for TV, like, unless you were in like a true prestige miniseries, you didn't have this was about as high of a budget undertaking as you were going to get.
So
I also think they were testing the waters to see if anybody cared, because that's why you get two more of these and a television show.
Also, just while we're talking about the motorcycle chase, I've thought about this at other times where I've seen this vehicle in movies. Whoever wanted to be in the sidecar?
That's worse. First
of all, doesn't that one... That one has a gun, right?
Yeah, you're always going to be the guy with the gun.
Yeah.
And so they're always going to be shooting aiming at for you, not the driver. Secondly, when this thing flips, and it's going to,
it's
because
going
it has to,
yeah.
because that's how much you get for $45, you're the guy who has to go right over on your head.
But it's worse than riding bitch. I'd rather ride bitch.
But you know what? If you take out the driver, you take out the gun and the driver. So, I mean, I don't know that you have that much more of a target, but I agree.
Do you know anybody in real life who said, I'm going to get a sidecar and ride in that?
Batman puts Robin.
That's right.
So they end up, they take out all the guys on motorcycles, but in the process, one of them dies, right? This is where we lose our first Dirty Dozen member.
Yeah.
And we'll just... I mean, who knows? I couldn't follow. If I couldn't follow the first one hardly, I have no idea who these people are as a part of this Dirty Dozen. So
in the first one, it would have been one of the other six, the six you don't know,
the red
don't
shirts.
Care about.
Yeah.
Here is one of the other 10.
Right. They're all basically red shirts in this movie.
Yes.
Practically. So they end up losing one of him. I'm reading online, causing a crash that claims the life of Anderson. So, just so you know, Paul, I know you're worried about it. Anderson had died here, okay?
Okay.
So,
you know what? I'm looking on IMDb, and it lists all the characters.
Do they have just numbers? Or
No, Anderson is not one of the first 20 characters listed.
Okay. So, the first Dirty Dozen member that dies isn't one of the first 20 people listed in the movie. Okay, so that tells you a lot about it. So, they end up needing a new vehicle because they crash this bus, and they end up going to this dude's farm and they want to steal his truck.
Where they go to a French farm where they grow baguettes.
Oh, they grow the baguettes are right off the vine. Yeah, they're picking them off the vine.
Yes.
So they try to steal this dude's truck. They're like, we're commandeering your truck. And he's like, why do these German guys speak English? And they're like, never mind that, we're stealing your truck. And he's like,
all the Germans in this movie speak English.
Yeah, they all do. Like, first of all,
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to mention this right at the beginning of this. I started to watch this on the DVD that Kevin got me.
Yeah.
It's a special feature. You can't get this movie
separately. Yeah, to be clear, this movie is a special feature on the Dirty Dozen Blu-ray. You cannot even buy it individually.
What's so weird, this movie is so hard to find. Like, I mean, it's on the Blu-ray and DVD as a special feature, but like, it doesn't stream anywhere. Nobody's illegally uploaded it to YouTube. It's not on another...
It's got to be because of TV rights. There has to be a different kind of home video right to it, because...
But the other two are available on Vudu. You can watch the other two on Vudu anytime you want.
That's weird. Yeah, it's got to be a weird rights issue, and I have no idea.
When I started watching this one, and it started with the stereotypical 80s TV font.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I said to myself, okay, here's where we go. And then the very first thing you see in this movie is two German guards at a checkpoint talking to each other in English.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, okay, that's the level of this.
That's
now, this is not a matter of budget. This is a matter of complete laziness.
Right. Yeah.
They couldn't get two people that spoke German and
subtitle it. It doesn't matter.
There's a scene later in the movie where, I think we're about to get there, where they're hiding out in a barn and dressed up as Germans. And then the German soldiers come in and see other people who are presumably German soldiers and then speak to them in English.
Yeah, right. It's you know, we're not trying to get like really nitpicky on this made-for-TV sequel 18 years later, but they're doing things that really take you out of it that wouldn't have taken that much thought. It's the fact that they put no thought and thought. They just said, this isn't necessary. Like, no one's going to care. But that's
pure
why this
laziness.
That's why this movie doesn't hold up, right? When you make little decisions like that, they all add up.
Totally.
And you don't get a great movie like the first one is. So,
well, you know what? We're talking about the original movie 53 years after it was made and praising it as a great movie. I don't think I would have praised this one as even a
movie
53 minutes into the movie.
Touche. So they the guy says, don't steal my truck. No, but I've got something you can use. And so he gives them this bullet-riddled Mercedes that, you know, they're making jokes jokes about saying, oh, this is a Mercedes-Benz. It's a great car. Oh, it was. And one of the guys is like, yeah, I can have this up and running in 23 minutes. Like, okay. Like, he just knows. Yeah. He knows that, you know, okay.
And incidentally, they then all pile into this Mercedes like the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah.
And all I can think to myself was, the truck would have been so much better. Just, what are you in a car
just
for?
Just steal the guy's truck. They had a
You got 11 people.
I know. That's what I'm saying. They had a conscience. They had a moment of conscience where they couldn't steal the guy's truck.
These
when
convicted
on
convicted murderers and rapists were like, well, we don't want to steal this dude's truck.
Yeah, but he's got baguettes to sell, Tom. How's he going to bring him to market in that old Mercedes? He's not.
Yeah.
So anyway, they end up, I don't know, they end up getting into that barn situation that Paul mentions, where once again, they use the exact same reason that they got caught the first time at the airfield. The German soldiers start talking to him, and then they see the black guy, and he's like, who are you? Who is your leader and what platoon, whatever, are you in? And Lee Marvin tries to talk to him, and a couple other guys try to talk. The German speaking guy, whoever he is, tries to talk to him. And he's like, no, I mean you. And then they end up getting into a shootout, and they're shooting all the German soldiers and all that. I don't know. Am I missing anything? That's about what happens.
No.
Was the Americans plan to talk their way out of this?
From a budget, I think it was the producer's plan with the budget. They're going to have to talk their way out of everything.
Right.
Because we don't have bullets.
Yeah. I will say
we don't even need bullets. We don't have squibs.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Well, even in the first movie, though, when they die outside of the castle and they don't even show fake blood or squibs or anything, when they're just like, oh, you got me, and they fall over, that's pretty terrible. You have to admit.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
All the deaths were just, oh, you got me, like playing. Like playing
kids
dead.
Playing cowboys.
Kids playing. Precisely. So
I will say there's one little moment I like in this, and it's in the scene I just mentioned that I didn't like, where the Germans come in and speak English. But like, I like that they have Lee Marvin pretending to be drunk to try to hide his accent. I was like, that'd be clever if he was actually speaking in German. You know what I mean?
Yeah, except for, wouldn't the other German guys be like, that's just gibberish.
Yeah.
Whether you're drunk or not, but yeah. So it didn't play as well as it could have, for sure.
Ugh.
So a few of them get wounded in this battle. But anyway, they're trying to go... They cut to the second-in-command guy, and I guess... some of the people are starting to be suspicious that he wants to take over command of the Nazis. And so like, he shoots one of the other guys. So I guess that's
on the train.
That's to show he's a really, really bad Nazi. He's shooting his
own. He does the Shane thing. Pick up that gun.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Yeah. And so he ends up killing him. Like, they're eating in the dining car or something. So the train arrives, and with all the Nazis, and
so the whole time they're wondering why this train is so important.
Oh,
and
that's
why it's under such heavy guard. And so
that's right.
Reisman tells him, "Oh, it's because it's a treasure train, and there's all this gold and stuff on
there."
Yeah,
treasure train.
And,
you see, treasure train.
Yeah, and
it's one of those
you
treasure
help
trains.
Me. I'll let you keep the treasure train. Like, it's like what are those? What's that candy? The Kinder egg? With the chocolate ball that they used to put toys
Wonder
inside
ball?
Of. Wonder ball. Like, it's a Wonder ball. But so he tells them there's all the treasure on there, and then he finally has to admit to them later that that was all just made up. And
so they buy it because they're like, well, you know, of course, you know, in Nazi occupied France and Poland and all that, the Nazis would, of course, imprison all the Jewish people, and they would take all their artwork and their gold and jewels and everything. So, I mean, at least to be fair to the script, like, the Nazis were confident.
There's some logic to the theory.
Yeah, they really were in history, stealing all these people's, you know, it was all horrendous, of course, and they were stealing all their belongings. And so Lee Marvin tried to make it out like, oh, this is the train transporting all the goods they had stolen from these different countries, and they're all getting them to some depot or something. So the guys go along with it, although at this point in the movie, it's this... Even Lee Marvin, you know, Reisman, says how stupid it is. These guys are like, well, you had your shot. We were contracted to kill the second in command at the airport. And because we didn't arrive in time, or at the train station or whatever, and because we didn't arrive in time, our contracts are done. Like, it's the stupidest logic ever, and they're all trying to escape.
Yeah, suddenly it's contract law.
Like,
yeah.
And so that's why Lee Marvin has to come up with this crazy idea, because otherwise they're, you know, he's not going to have anyone to fight with him. So they believe him, and they go about their business, and eventually, I don't even remember what happens other than when Hitler lands on the plane. What else happens in this movie?
They get to the train, and then a plane lands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is pretty much the next thing. There's not much else to it. The movie was in a 2-hour time slot, which means there was, you know, 30 minutes of commercials.
Sure, it's like an hour, 25 minute movie or something. So
yeah, by the time you take out the credits,
not much happens. I mean, yeah, they get there to try to kill the second in command, and they end up giving the black guy the job as being a sniper. Because this whole time, it's like Lee Marvin just hasn't told him what his job is going to be. He's like, are you going to let me know what I'm doing? And he doesn't. And finally, when they get here, they're like, here's a sniper rifle for you.
Okay, let me stop right here, because
please.
It's at this point, watching this piece of drick, that I thought to myself, why do we need the rest of the Dirty Dozen? If the mission is to kill
a guy with
this
a sniper
general,
rifle?
Yeah.
No, yeah. If the mission is to kill this general,
you don't need 12 people.
Yeah, you don't need 12 people. You take the best guy who could shoot from a long distance and find where the general is going to be and let him take the general out and then leave.
Isn't it a little easier to hide 12, one person than 12?
Yes. Yeah,
like, they're sneaking around the countryside if they had
as opposed
people.
To the plan in this movie, which is once he takes the general out, we'll then run 10 or 11 of us into a heavily armed airport facility and railroad facility swarming with Nazis. That can't possibly go wrong.
It's so stupid.
Yeah.
You're right. It's
yeah, like... the plan in the first one relied on brute force, where this one is entirely stealth driven.
Right, they were taking over a castle as opposed to sniping someone. So you're right, it's ludicrous. As much as this movie is basically like a soft reboot of the first one or a made-for-television reboot, they just do everything worse.
Yeah, it's like laziness. If you watch the first Dirty Dozen and you thought to yourself, I wish this wasn't as good.
Boy, do I have a movie for you.
Yeah, like I'm like, if only this wasn't so entertaining.
I'm too entertained by this movie.
Right. Like I think with my constitution, I'm not ready for this sort of level of entertainment.
What's better than 2.5 hours of jam-packed entertainment than 1.5 hours of terrible, boring, illogical acting?
And let me go to one other piece of, again, screenwriting laziness.
Please.
The Larry Wilcox character, of course, is a country hayseed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But he knew how to fly a crop duster back home. And he mentions that early on. And I think to myself, well, he's going to have to fly the getaway plane.
Right.
I don't know whether they're going to have a getaway plane, but
of course they're the same thing.
Boy, let's talk about Larry Wilcox for a second. Boy, he was going for it.
Yeah.
he thought he was in a good movie. Like, this was his time to shine.
Absolutely. But there's that scene where his character, when they're taking off in the plane the first time, he looks through the cockpit door and says, wow, look at all those buttons and dials up there. And then at the end of the movie, he's put on a plane with a lot of buttons and dials. Yeah. And it's not a crop duster, and he knows how to fly it, no problem.
Go ahead and step on that right rudder and pull up on this. And
what's with the faces he makes while he's flying
like
the plane?
He is
like
grunting.
He looks like he's trying to poop.
He does
the whole time he's flying the plane.
I mean, I don't know how hard it is to fly 1945 German bomber planes. Believe it or not,
it causes constipation.
It is something else watching him fly this thing. You're right. He was going for it. You got to give him that. So the black guy ends up getting the German officer in his sights, but then who steps off this plane that arrives? But Hitler himself. And so now he's got this moral quandary of, do I just take out Hitler, even though...
Okay, I'm going to have to say, I kind of dig this scene. Like, I kind of like the whole idea of, like, how do you not pull the trigger on
Hitler? No, I 100% agree with you. He doesn't know the plan of the superiors.
What I don't like is that they inserted the commercial break in the middle of
Yes, while he's aiming the gun. Dun, 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 dun.
New Calgon.
And then fade out.
Hey, Hitler has just arrived at the airport. Try new Calgon with extra white rinsing action.
Oh, Don't put the ad for a Mercedes-Benz there, I'll tell you that.
No.
The new Volkswagen Passat.
Right. So the guy who plays Hitler, like, that's his thing. He played Hitler 5 times. He's also the Hitler that you'll get in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah, like, he plays Hitler. He played Hitler 5 times. Oh. And just to show versatility, yeah, he played Himmler 3 times.
Oh, okay. Because
he's, you know, didn't want to get typecast.
That's some range, and, yeah.
And but he's also in a very famous iconic scene that that I think almost anyone of a certain age will remember. But he is the actor who Darth Vader force chokes in Empire Strikes Back.
Wow. Okay.
So there you go.
So is he British? Most all of them are British, you know, and the
almost all of them are. Yeah.
Well, let me mention something else about this guy. I didn't know any of that you just mentioned until just now, Tom. And I realized in this movie he says no lines, which means he got paid minimum scale. He played Hitler in a TV movie and got paid $100.
Jeez.
You would think that there's like some sort of bump for having to play Hitler, like you get extra. Like, if you're going to be, like, the face in an ad for a drug for STDs, like, you should get extra.
I think you get an extra V or schnitzel in the commissary. That's about it.
Yeah.
They put it on a baguette, a day-old baguette.
So, yeah, so he has this moral quandary, which, I mean, I get it. I totally like that decision that he has to make because he doesn't know the general's plans and that they want to kill Hitler or don't want to kill Hitler because they need.
I will say I watched this movie when it originally aired.
Okay.
You know, and this is the only thing I remember from it.
Oh, you
know,
it's, I mean, it seems like the memorable scene.
Yeah.
So he has to go back and forth. This sniper rifle has Hitler in his sights, but he ends up shooting, I don't know what the other guy's name is, whatever, not Hitler, the second in command, General Dietrich. Sorry.
Yeah.
He ends up killing the other guy. And so then they, Paul says, now that they've killed him, obviously the whole base is on alert and they have to go into their big firefight and all that. And so,
but they find out that the train is carrying treasure.
Well, isn't it? Well, yeah, it's like,
it's artwork and Beethoven's piano that they decide to play while under fire.
He just guessed. He just got it right, I guess.
That's my favorite line in the whole movie, though. Where the one guy is like, they're like going through the stuff, and he's like, "This isn't treasure. It's like art." He's like, and Lee Marvin just goes, "That's because you're dumb." And the only good line delivery I think Lee Marvin has in the whole movie. Like, I think I almost think he was frustrated with the actor because just the way he says it.
By the way, if you want to see a pretty good movie again from World War II. That was made in the 60s about a train full of stuff that the Nazis had stolen, particularly artwork. There was a movie literally called The Train with Burt Lancaster as the engineer of this train that is full of this stuff. And he's been ordered at gunpoint to take the train from occupied France into Germany so that the Germans can have this stuff and keep it away from the Allies. And along the way, he has members of the French resistance joining him secretly to essentially try to, you know, derail this train from its mission, pardon the pun.
So maybe that should have been the Dirty Dozen too. You know?
Yeah.
Should have remade that.
Yeah.
But I think the person who wrote the script for this must have seen that and said, okay, here's my inspiration. I'm going to have Beethoven's piano be on this train.
Ooh.
And nobody else said, you're what?
Yeah. that's the treasure they're all looking for. So they end up, they get in the big firefight with all the Nazis and everything, and they end up stealing that plane that Hitler had arrived in. And this is where you get the pilot has to fight them. One of their engines blows out, he has to fly, and the engine blows out, and they end up having to land it. Which I thought this was probably the best scene in the movie. Personally, I thought the plane, like, at least I'm just like, are they going to crash or not? I mean, which clearly
they're
not.
Did you think that when they're coming into the cliffs of Dover, you thought they're going to go straight into that white wall?
But it to me, it felt the most like a real scene in a movie. I don't know. It just, like, to me, I'm like, okay.
Until the parachuting How bad was the
parody? Oh my god. I thought they just used footage from the first one. It was so bad.
Oh my god, the parachuting is there, like you never see anyone actually, you never see the parachute, just the strings letting them down.
It's like stock footage from like 8mm war footage of the parachutes, and then it cuts to like Lee Marvin close up with some like strings he's pulling or whatever. Yeah. Like it's so horrible.
Terrible.
But anyway, so they have to land the plane, the engine's blowing out, and so the pilot guy poops his pants trying to pull up on the thing and get him over the hill like Tom was talking about. They narrowly escape it by a few feet, and they land, and this is where is it a Scotsman or something? I don't know who this countryside.
No, an Englishman. It's the English countryside.
Okay, so and I'm not keeping track of what these where they are, but
well, that's
so,
the cliffs of Dover, which is the end of the English Channel and the beginning of England.
Okay, yeah, I mean
whatever.
Yes, so the guy ends up like pulling a shotgun on him because they're in a Nazi plane and they all have Nazi uniforms, and all it takes is Lee Marvin to speak to him, and he's like, oh, you're Yanks. Okay.
Yeah.
And Lee Marvin grabs the gun out of his hand. He's like, let's go get a drink. And then the movie just ends, and it's probably the exact same line as the first one.
It's Ernest Borgnine this time, yeah. But it's like he's reading the exact same thing about, oh, their sentences were commuted and blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
It's the exact same thing. Ugh. And that's it.
So bad. So bad. I just some background, because since this is made for TV movie, I won't talk about what the top grossing movies of that year were. But would you like to know what else aired on television?
Sure, let's go to the TV guide.
I find that kind of stuff interesting. So the lead in for this show was TV's Bloopers and Practical Jokes, which was
perfect.
I mean,
before
you had viral videos, like this is what you had.
I know, but you talk about like lead-in shows. Oh, if you love bloopers and gags and boners or whatever they call them, why don't you watch The Dirty Dozen 2?
Tom, was that Dick Clark and Ed McMahon?
I think at this point it was just Dick Clark, but originally they were specials that they hosted together, and then I think when it went to series, it was just became Dick Clark hosting them. But that was a big show. But so yeah, so on ABC, you had Hardcastle and McCormick, and then followed by a TV movie called Consenting Adult, a drama, a nice piece of counter programming to The Dirty Dozen. This is a drama about a young man coming out to his parents. It starred Martin Sheen. And I'm trying to remember who the actress was. It was a fairly big name actress.
Marlo Thomas.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, yeah. I was like, I knew it was somebody pretty well known. And then on CBS, you had Scarecrow and Mrs. King, followed by Kate and Allie and Newhart, the one where he owns the inn, not where he's a psychiatrist or psychologist.
Yep.
And then in the 10 o'clock hour, 9 o'clock central, was Cagney and Lacey. So that ran against the Dirty Dozen, which and in case you're concerned, Dirty Dozen Next Mission won the night with a 23.8 rating.
Wow.
So Consenting Adult got a 23.1, though. It was a close call, but Dirty Dozen did win the night. I mean, people tuned in to see this thing, and
they sold their ads, I guess.
And you you do get more of them, right? Like you get, so in 1987,
well, that's true. Yeah,
in 1987, you'll get the Dirty Dozen Deadly Mission, and then in 88, you'll get Dirty Dozen The Fatal Mission, which I don't know if they realize deadly and fatal both mean the same thing.
So is there any connective tissue other than bringing an actor back from the first one? Are the characters connected in any way? Do you know?
So I have not watched those, although I believe as of this recording, both of those are available to watch for free on Vudu with ads.
Okay.
But so Lee Marvin died in 87. So my guess is he was in probably too poor of health to be in the next one. Mm-hmm. So they bring in Telly Savalas, who played Maggot in the first one. He's not playing Maggot because, one, that character's dead.
That would be difficult.
Two, that would make no sense that they would put him in charge of anything. The only cast member that returns at this point is Ernest Borgnine.
Hmm.
So that's the sole connective tissue that's left.
So is he in all of them?
He's in all of them, but
yes.
He's in all of the made-for-TV movies, correct.
Wow.
And so All of these aired on NBC, and then the plot of this one, learning of a Nazi plot to attack Washington, D.C. with a deadly nerve gas, Major Wright leads 12 convicts on a suicide mission deep into occupied France to destroy the secret factory where the poison is made. So at least you would need 12 people for that. Like, that's, you know.
Right.
And I think the biggest name in that one was probably among the Dirty Dozen was probably Bo Svenson, who's best known as the guy who replaced Joe Don Baker in the Walking Tall franchise.
Oh.
And
wow.
then you get the next one in 88, which is called The Fatal Mission. Telly Savalas returns. Ernest Borgnine is also back. The plot concerns Major Wright and his convict commando squad attempting to stop 12 top Nazis who are trying to organize a Fourth Reich. So there's a mirror Dirty Dozen. I best guess we could call them a Dirtier Dozen.
The Bizarro Dirty Dozen.
I'm looking at the IMDb listing of the cast here. Jeff Conaway.
There's some big names.
Jeff
in this
Conaway,
one.
Who was on Taxi and never did anything after that. Eric Estrada.
He was in Grease as well. And he was on one of the Stargate spinoffs, I believe.
Okay. Eric Estrada. Yeah. Well, since Larry Wilcox had gotten to be in it, the other guy from Chips finally gets to be in the third sequel. Ernie Hudson, who was just never able to cash in from his time as the fourth Ghostbuster. So he's in this. A fighter named Ray Boom Boom Mancini. And a football player named John Matusak. And then right down towards the bottom of that page, Heather Thomas.
You get your first female Dirty Dozen member. That is correct.
Who I think was famous at the time for co-starring with William Shatner in The Fall Guy.
No, The Fall Guy was Lee Majors.
Oh.
The Fall Guy was Lee Majors. William Shatner was...
T.J. Hooker.
Was T.J. Hooker. There we go. Yeah. Thank you.
But Heather Thomas, I think, was in The Fall Guy.
She was. She was... Yeah, you are correct.
Yeah.
So, but that wasn't enough. In 1988, you got a TV show. For some reason, they didn't get Telly Savalas to do the TV show. I have no idea why. He was alive until 1994. He was working, I think, until 93. So he was up for it. But he was working, not he was up for it, and they passed on him. But from best I can tell, nobody from either of these other TV movies popped up in this. And the TV show aired 11 episodes on Fox. It was not an NBC show. And it starred Ben Murphy and a young John Slattery.
Interesting.
Who people might know as, will probably most likely know as Roger from Mad Men. And a young Ian McShane pops up on an episode. So,
now, I never saw that original series, but if that were like a Netflix or Amazon Prime Video series now, it would be 10 or 12 episodes, but it would all tell one story.
And that's not what this show, all of these episodes, I don't think they've ever been released legally, but all of the entire series seems to be on YouTube bootlegged if anybody cares enough to go watch it.
No thanks.
It actually, it actually got a good, like when I was researching this, I came across a review from the LA Times and they actually gave it a good review. They were like, for what this is really well done. I think each week it was a different mission, which is dumb for a show like this. I was thinking the same thing Paul said, which is that one season should be a whole mission. Yeah. But it actually got a pretty solid review in the LA Times. So whatever it's worth.
But that's what you're into, check it out.
Did either of you say, I think I heard one of you say in the first episode that we did about the original Dirty Dozen, that they're working on a remake now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, David Ayer's the guy who was behind Suicide Squad, is a huge fan, and he is attached to a remake of the Dirty Dozen.
See, now to me, a huge fan of the Dirty Dozen would say, no, you don't need to make a remake. Show the original.
Well, he's already done it too. I mean, Suicide Squad is such a spiritual remake of the Dirty Dozen. It's interesting that they went and instead of being like, okay, he kind of did that, but did it in an interesting Marvel-esque way of like a genre film that fits with this story.
Right.
They're like, oh yeah, he did it. Okay, now let's really do it. Like
It's odd. So many things in Hollywood get bandied about and never happen.
That's true.
Like we talked about last week, the Ellen DeGeneres reboot of Oh God. Like that never came to fruition. So,
right.
Just real quick, returning to the original movie, I just found this interesting. Some of the people behind the next mission, the original movie that we're talking about, not the.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So it was directed by Andrew V. McClagan, who, interestingly enough, directed another made-for-TV sequel to a World War II movie. In 1989, he would make Return from the River Kwai.
Oh.
Really?
I just thought it was weird. But this is a real director, though. Like, he made 5 John Wayne movies. I mean, not great ones, but they were still trusting him with John Wayne movies.
Okay.
So that says something. But he also directed, for our nerd friends, they'll enjoy this. He is responsible for what would be, in my opinion, one of the greatest episodes of Mystery Science Theater 3000. He directed the Joe Don Baker classic Mitchell, which if you haven't seen Mitchell, cannot recommend that episode of MST3K highly.
That's
enough.
Great. So he did a terrible movie that made for a great episode of.
Yeah. And then the writer of the next mission, which he shouldn't get the credit. They should have just gave it to the guy who wrote the first movie. But yeah. Was Michael Caine, not that one. And C-A-N-E. He wrote the Tom Cruise movie, All the Right Moves.
Okay.
He also wrote the just awful Legend of the Lone Ranger when they tried to reboot the Lone Ranger in like 79 or 1980. And then he must have been friends with Sherwood Schwartz because he directed an episode of Gilligan's Island, the one with where they find the homing pigeon.
Hmm.
And he also directed an episode of The Brady Bunch, the one where they get the pool table in their garage.
Nice.
So I just found those things interesting and thought I would pass them along. So they're
more interesting than the movie, certainly.
Yeah, that's for sure. So anyway, I guess that's all of that then, right? So
that's it.
Well, I guess let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Paul. You can find me on my website, harrisonline.com.
And this is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online at facebook.com/real spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. And of course, our Patreon, patreon.com/real spoilers. So that's it for this one. Next week, it looks like we will return to doing some new releases. We're going to tackle the new Andy Samberg movie, Palm Springs, and the Charlize Theron movie, The Old Guard. I don't know if it's got a the or not.
The Old Guard.
Okay. Both. And Palm Springs is on Hulu and Old Guard is on Netflix. So if you want to play along at home. So anyway, that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Flake crushes Enchantress's heart.
Now that we're alone, Coop, there's something I want to tell you. Remember when you had the crabs and the only thing that made you feel better was this lotion? Well, I found another use for it. It feels so good. It makes me want to sing. Just like that night we spent in the tattoo parlor in Chicago. Come on, baby. I'm too sexy for my shirt. Too sexy for my shirt. So sexy it hurts. And I'm too sexy for my car. Too sexy for my car. Too sexy my car.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.